This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm Maxine Clark, and you're listening to another edition of The Economist. The first article from this edition of The Economist is titled, Who's the Big Boss of the Global South? In a dog-eat-dog world, the competition is fierce. Sniffy types disdain the notion of, quote, the Global South, unquote, which has become something of a meme in recent years. Its inadequacies are obvious. Three words could never capture the complexities of a group of more than 100 countries spread from Morocco to Malaysia and beyond. But the phrase has been adopted by Joe Biden, Emmanuel Macron, and Xi Jinping. The simplest working definition is that it refers to most, but not quite all, non-Western countries. Its use also denotes how emerging economies want more power over global affairs and often have a critical view of Western policy. Thus, the Global South is said to be outraged by the war in Gaza and unhappy about Western decisions on Ukraine, COVID-19, and climate policy. Sarang Shidore of the Quincy Institute of Responsible Statecraft, an American think tank, says, quote, the Global South exists not as a coherent, organized grouping so much as a geopolitical fact, unquote. If the Global South exists, sort of, then who leads it? Narendra Modi has suggested India could be its voice. Luiz Ignacio Lula da Silva, known as Lula, the president of Brazil, reckons his country could be too. To examine this question, we have worked with a group of scholars to crunch data on trade, financial and diplomatic links. Our conclusion is, counterintuitively, that America still has more influence than any other country over the Global South, but that within the grouping itself, China has become the most powerful member, giving Mr. Xi the strongest claim to leadership. The sting is that China's influence has glaring limits and could even backfire, and other powers are on the rise. We worked with the Pardee Center for International Futures, PCIF, at the University of Denver. It has built an index of states' power from 1960 to 2022. The main metric is catchingly known as, quote, formal bilateral influence capacity, unquote, a measure of how much power country A may have over country B based on two dimensions. First, bandwidth, or the extent of connections back and forth, the volume of trade, diplomatic representation, and so on. Second, dependence, on how much country B needs country A's arms, loans, investment, etc. More connections mean more chances for country A to exert influence, and asymmetry in power makes it easier to do so. Think of China's power over Pakistan, for instance. Ample connections and China enjoys asymmetric influence. The exercise examines power relations among the 130-odd members of the Global South found in G77, a UN grouping. America has been the country with the most influence over the G77 since the 1970s. Its influence capacity has been more or less constant, even as the allure of Britain and France has waned. But it is increasingly rivaled by China, which after 40 years of relative insignificance saw its influence grow from around 2000. According to the index, China's influence capacity over the G77 is roughly double that of France, the third most influential country, and around three times that of Britain, India, or the UAE. seeing red. China wields the most influence in 31 countries. Its clout is greatest in Pakistan, Bangladesh, Russia, and several states in Southeast Asia. By contrast, the next most powerful member of the Global South, India, is top dog with only 6 G77 members. According to an earlier analysis by PCIF from 1992 to 2020, the number of countries over which China had more influence than America almost doubled, from 33 to 61. Recently, China has become a lot keener on the whole idea of the grouping. Last year, Mr. Xi and senior Chinese officials began referring to their country as part of the Global South, a description they had hitherto resisted, a term credited to an American left-wing academic in the 1960s, in favor of phrases like family of developing countries. In September, China published proposals on changing international institutions, rules and laws. It claimed this was a version of true multilateralism, where universal security replaced universal values. In other words, a system not run by an interfering West. China is intensely strategic about winning influence and targets swing states with infrastructure support, financing, and more. From 2000 to 2021, it funded more than 20,000 infrastructure projects, many of which were under the Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, across 165 countries with aid or credit worth $1.3 trillion. Some analysts have noted data showing that credit from large state-backed lenders, such as the Export-Import Bank of China, is drying up. But a paper published in November by Aid Data, a group from William and Mary University, argues otherwise. Contrary to conventional wisdom, Beijing is not in retreat, says Bradley Parks, one of the authors. The paper finds that there are many more entities extending credit to the developing world. In 2021, it counted lending of $80 billion a year. China remains the single largest source of international development finance in the world. China is targeting geopolitical fence sitters. Aid Data reckons that around two-thirds of Chinese financing goes to toss-up countries where neither China nor America clearly holds sway. The group has identified a quid pro quo. If a government increases its share of votes at the UN General Assembly, UNGA, that align with China's by 10 percentage points, it can expect a 276% increase on average in financing from Beijing. China has also used its weight to curry favor on subjects such as its repression in Xinjiang. From 2000 to 2021, low- and middle-income countries voted on foreign policy decisions with China 75% of the time at the UNGA. China uses other tools too. It is a main trading partner of more than 120 countries. It has provided $240 billion mostly since 2016 in emergency financing of the sort the IMF specializes in. China also builds infrastructure projects quickly in developing countries, pleasing their elites, and subsidizes the rollout of digital tech, such as that of Huawei. Over the past 5 years, it has overtaken Russia as the main source of weapons for sub-Saharan Africa. Though China's leadership position among the G77 is formidable, it faces problems. First, its influence is limited in reach and intensity. Recent polls in Africa and Southeast Asia, for example, show split support for America and China in developing countries. China's conduct and political values may stunt its influence. Its actions in business and politics have attracted calls for accountability. Countries sometimes lay the blame for their debt crisis at its door. And the country's disdain for values-based interactions, it preaches non-interference instead, is apparent. Most of the one-party state's closest pals are also autocratic. Places in the global south where democratic values are considered strong, such as Brazil, are unlikely to have a close cultural connection with China. What is more, as China draws nearer to the likes of Iran and Russia, it risks allying with countries that want to destroy rather than to reform the international order. Meanwhile, China's economic reputation could deteriorate. The public support it won through its lending binge happened before the money needed repaying. Some 75% of its BRI loans will require the principal to be paid back by 2030. It is probably no coincidence that the share of people in Africa who see China as having a positive impact on its development dipped from 59% to 49% from 2019 to 2022, according to Afrobarometer, a pollster. Mr. Xi's latest response to economic woes in China is to launch massive industrial subsidies, which could lead to manufactured goods flooding markets of other emerging economies. Although some consumers may benefit, another China shock may stunt the industrial ambitions of governments in the global south. Even as China faces headwinds, new rivals are emerging whose influence in the global south is rising. India is a frontrunner. The number of Indian embassies in Africa increased from 25 to 43 between 2012 and 2022. It is the continent's fourth largest trade partner and fifth largest source of foreign direct investment, according to Mr. Modi. Meanwhile, India is also offering its stack of digital platforms, including biometric identity technology, to countries such as Ethiopia, Sierra Leone, and Sri Lanka. Some of India's power is unquantifiable. As a flawed democracy with an ultra-pragmatic foreign policy, it has forged closer bonds with America at the same time as refusing to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It is closer to the median world view among the G77 than is China. India's pitch to lead is also substantively different, because it worries more about China-led Asia than an American-led world. It is also pragmatic about its approach to reforming international rules. The country wants to be a bridge to the West, not a battering ram. Buyer's remorse. Other countries have specialist claims to power. If China is a supermarket of influence, then its rival in the global south are like boutiques offering other members a smaller range of bespoke goods. Gulf states are investing some of their hydrocarbon windfalls in renewable energy projects and mines in the developing world. Brazil, the world's second largest agricultural exporter, is using its chairmanship of the G20 this year to promote food security in the global south. South Africa sees itself improbably as a moral leader of the global south, taking Israel to the International Court of Justice for alleged genocide in Gaza and leading a peace mission of African countries to Ukraine and Russia. Lastly, America and its allies are not out of the game. Rich countries in the OECD group spend more than $200 billion annually in overseas aid. Loans make up most of China's financing. Trade between sub-Saharan Africa and, in total, America and the euro area is greater than that between the region and China, according to IMF data. And in addition to alliances such as NATO, America has defense partnerships with 76 countries. China hopes to see off this competition. Yet, even if it does, it will be the leading power in a group that will never be cohesive. China is not going to welcome India permanently into the UN Security Council. Brazil and South Africa regularly disagree at the WTO over agriculture. Debtor countries and creditors like China want different things from World Bank and IMF reform. China will find that countries in the global south will pursue their national interests and often come into conflict with the West, China, and each other. The global south, in other words, does not want a leader. It is a zone of contest, just not one that can be located on a map. And the following is a spot of world news in business in the past few weeks. The Biden administration said it would provide $6.6 billion in direct funding to TSMC to support its facilities in Arizona for manufacturing the world's most advanced semiconductors. TSMC, based in Taiwan and the world's largest contract chip maker, will have three sites in Phoenix when it completes a new factory there. It is increasing its investment to $65 billion, the largest ever foreign direct investment in a greenfield project, meaning built from scratch in America. TSMC supplies chips to Apple and Nvidia for use in smartphones and artificial intelligence. Intel unveiled its Gaudi 3 chip for AI, which it claims is faster and more power efficient than Nvidia's H100. It tested the chip on two open-source large language models. Llama, which is run by Meta, and Falcon, a project backed by Abu Dhabi. Intel also announced a plan to create, with other tech companies, an open platform for enterprise AI that will accelerate deployment of secure generative AI systems. Disney is to crack down on users who share passwords to its streaming services. Bob Iger, Disney's chief executive, said the crackdown would be gradually rolled out to different countries starting in June. Netflix implemented a similar policy last year, and it has since reported a surge in subscribers. Boeing's safety record was in the spotlight again. An engineer at Boeing alleged that the company took shortcuts on quality and safety when it manufactured 787 and 777 jets, leaving them with potential structural flaws. Boeing described the claims as, quote, inaccurate, unquote, and the Federal Aviation Administration investigated yet another incident involving a Boeing plane, this time an engine panel that fell off a 737-800 during takeoff from Denver. Meanwhile, Alaska Air received $160 million in compensation from Boeing for the panel that fell off one of its aircraft in January, leaving a gaping hole in the plane. The airline said it expects further payments. Tesco, Britain's biggest supermarket chain, reported a big rise in pre-tax profit to $2.9 billion for the 12 months ending February 24th. It expects higher profits this year as inflationary pressures have lessened substantially. Meanwhile, John Lewis, a troubled department store and supermarket chain, appointed Jason Terry, a former senior executive at Tesco, as its new chair. Dame Sharon White held the position for 5 years, the shortest ever tenure in the job. A victory of sorts. The EU's General Court ruled that sanctions imposed on Mikhail Friedman, a Russian investor, and Peter Avin, his business partner, between February 2022 and March 2023, must be annulled. The court found that the EU had not sufficiently substantiated its reasons for linking Messrs. Friedman and Avin to Vladimir Putin's regime after Russia invaded Ukraine. Mr. Friedman is one of Russia's most prominent businessmen. Both men are still subject to sanctions not covered by the judgment. Two bits of economic data changed market calculations about the Federal Reserve's path towards interest rate cuts. America's annual inflation rate rose again to 3.5% in March from 3.2% in February. And American employers created 303,000 jobs in March, the highest number since last May, suggesting that the economy remains red hot. Stock markets sagged, and the yield on government bonds jumped in response to both sets of data. Investors have narrowed their bets on when and how the Fed will cut this year, though some of those bets of up to 7 cuts were widely optimistic. Fitch reduced its outlook for China's sovereign credit rating from stable to negative, but retained the country's A+ rating. Moody's took similar action in December. Fitch forecasts that China's central and local government debt will rise to 61.3% of GDP this year. In 2019, it was 38.5% of GDP. HSBC decided to sell its business in Argentina and will book a $1 billion pre-tax charge in its first quarter earnings related to the sale. The bank said it would also have to acknowledge $4.9 billion in losses on its books linked to the falling value of the peso when the deal closes, though this would neither affect its financial strength nor its tangible net asset value. HSBC has been gradually pulling back from markets outside Asia in order to focus on its business there. Serenity and Strife. We'll have AI that is smarter than any one human, probably around the end of next year, predicted Elon Musk in an interview. Mr. Musk's prophecy is conditioned on the continuing supply of chips and electricity. Meanwhile, Mr. Musk had more earthly matters to consider when he caused a huge political row in Brazil by calling for the resignation of a Supreme Court judge whom he suspects of ordering a block on certain right-wing accounts on his messaging service, X. And the final article from The Economist is titled, What's in a Name? The Higgs Particle Duality. For physics, the Higgs boson was a totem, a selling point, and an inspiring parable. For Peter Higgs, it was a bit of a pain. If it had been up to Peter Higgs, the world would have taken no heed of his death on April 8th, nor, for that matter, of the 94 years of life which preceded it. He valued the respect of his colleagues and treasured his occasional bright ideas about the way the universe worked. The fact that one of those bright ideas ended up boiled down into an object bearing his name, which became the subject of a world-encompassing multi-billion dollar quest, was a source of some exasperation. The Higgs boson discovery, he said, quote, ruined my life, unquote. Dr. Higgs' best-known bright idea was arcane but crucial. There are two types of fundamental particles, fermions and bosons. The symmetrical nature of the equations which describe bosons implies that they should be massless. By the 1950s, though, it seemed that some bosons did have mass. Some fundamental symmetries were in practice broken. Untangling the mats of broken symmetries became a preoccupation of particle physicists. Dr. Higgs' contribution, made over a few weeks in the summer of 1964, was a mathematical description of a new boson that could give mass to bosons in need of it. In 1983, a daring modification of a particle accelerator at CERN, that's CAPS, C-E-R-N, the European Physics Lab near Geneva, produced direct evidence of three massive bosons, two W's and a Z, predicted by the theory which unified electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. This boson, Bonanza, left some American physicists miffed. They told the government which funded them that America was losing an important race. The proposed comeback was a superconducting supercollider, SSC, a particle accelerator of extraordinary power that would be 87 kilometers in circumference. The Higgs boson was a key part of the pitch. The particle's existence was predicted by theory, but, as had been the case with the W's and Z's, its discovery was impossible without a powerful enough machine. The SSC would be that machine. Journalists grasped that if there was a Higgs particle, there must also be a Higgs. 24 years after writing his original paper, Dr. Higgs found himself doing his first interview. Leon Lederman, a champion of the SSC, to whom press availability was a joy, not a chore, dubbed the Higgs, quote, the God particle, unquote, thereby increasing the hype and the sales of his thus-titled book. In 1993, Congress cancelled the SSC. Its European rival, CERN's LHC, carried on. Physicists there thought that the Higgs was a known unknown, which their machine, though smaller, still stood a good chance of producing, and it was central to the way it was sold to politicians and the public. The LHC delivered the goods in 2012, and the Nobel Prize Committee followed suit the next year. Dr. Higgs grinned and bore the attention. It was not just that the particle carried his name. Their story was so beguiling, the humble theorist, in his garret, actually a third-floor flat in Edinburgh's New Town, who goes unheralded for decades, but whose ideas eventually change the world, how's that for the untrammeled power of the singular mind? But it was never really true. Dr. Higgs, as he always made clear, was one of many scientists coming up with similar ideas at a time when using soundbite-friendly baubles to win funding for city-sized accelerators was still unthinkable. And that's all the time we have for today. You've been listening to another edition of The Economist. Until next time, I'm Maxine Clark, signing off. Goodbye.